Good morning. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And it's Wednesday, 11 a.m. Central Time. And this program is every Wednesday. Sorry I missed everyone last week. I was traveling doing a little bit of work on the road and actually running into some very interesting new material for this program today, some things that I thought we ought to be talking about. You know, the program is changing the way we see the world. In other words, looking at the things that are going on around us, taking a little different perspective on those, and maybe coming to a little bit different conclusion about what's happening next. I mean, I think it's not about so much predicting the future as seeing it unfold in front of us with just the advent of what's happening around us, both socially, politically, economically, and for this program, I think most often scientifically, how those changes might impact us now and in the future. Again, my name is Dr. Nick Begich. This show is every Wednesday. I missed everyone last week as I was traveling. I ran into this article. It was actually sent to me by a very good friend, my friend William Bacon III, and for that name maybe rings a bell for a few people. His relative, his great-great-great relative was Sir Francis Bacon, who actually did the transcription, some say, on the King James Version of the Bible, was a scholar and a quite interesting guy. But Bill sent me an article, and he does that from time to time. He's also the guy that does some of my filming for me on my DVDs that I've produced over the years. But the article he sent me was one, and now that it's over with, we can talk about this article. It says, "Beware August 22nd and Iran's Apocalyptic View." And this article was actually put in as a newsprint article, but the person that is quoted is a gentleman by the name of Bernard Lewis, who's a professor at Princeton University and the author of a book called From Babel to Dragon Man, Interpreting the Middle East, and it's the Oxford Press 2004. And it's a discussion about the worldview of some Muslims. And I think this is extremely important when we start to consider the political circumstances that we're in today. And I've never really seen this in this written form, but I want to read a couple of sections of this article. I want to talk a little bit about it and talk about how it really drives so much of what's going on today. And what the article started out with was a discussion, and many will remember this from the Cold War. Those that are a little bit younger might not remember it. It was MAD, or Mutual Assured Destruction. And it was this kind of view, MAD, M-A-D, was kind of a view of the world that said, hey, as long as we have a gazillion nukes and the Russians have a gazillion nukes, and whoever our traditional adversaries during the Cold War, China, Russia, and their allies, we would kind of agree that we would agree not to fire at each other because we knew that in the end we'd probably destroy everything in the process, and neither side really wanted to do that. So that was sort of our thermostat on a global apocalypse at the time, was to keep people in line by being so overwhelmingly armed that nobody would be so foolish as to make that move. Well, that worldview really only holds if you have a view that respects a life and believes that that life is sacred, quite frankly, and the way that we treat life is sacred. So we have that view in the West. They also have that view in terms of the Muslim faith, but they translate or they interpret it or they see it through a worldview that's much, much different than ours. Understanding that worldview might help us actually get to the finish line. And I want to talk about a little bit about sort of the structure of the history and how this worldview takes form in the Middle East. And I want to talk about the Iranian situation particularly, because this is where the heat and the action is and where the roots of the problem will likely spring. And it comes, you got to go back. We got to go back politically. We'll talk a little bit about the political history of what happened in Iran, how that bred an environment where a radical view of the world could emerge that would be quite contrary to ours. We'll be right back right after this break. You're listening to Dr. Nick Begich on Changing the Way We See the World. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World, and you're listening to Dr. Nick Begich on RBN Live, and we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m., so please pass that word on. Today we're talking a little bit about the situation in the Middle East, talking a little bit about the history and what brings people to the point that they're willing to sacrifice, as they see it, sacrifice their lives for their political purposes. And we need to go back. We were just before the break going to start to talk a little bit about the history and what leads people to this place. And we've got to go back to the Shah of Iran. You know, the Shah of Iran was installed by the United States back in the 50s, basically as a buffer, as a puppet government to put a little wedge between the Middle East and the former Soviet Union. And as a consequence, we helped the guy get into power, and then he turned into a tyrant. I mean, he really was a tyrant. We armed him up to the hilt. I mean, we supplied him so many arms, so many weapons. But he was known in his country as one of these dictators that was involved in torturing and just the extended suffering of his own people. But we propped him up because we really needed that buffer there. Eventually, you know, when you oppress people with a government they really didn't plan on and they really didn't want, whether we like it or not, they eventually get fairly rebellious. And that's exactly what happened. And if we go back to the 70s, and a lot of listeners these days maybe weren't even alive then, but in the late 70s, then we had the kidnapping of Americans in Iran. And as a consequence, a huge conflict emerged. And out of that conflict came a brand new, much more radical form of leadership in the Islamic world, and that was the Ayatollah. Now, I want to read a little bit of this article because it starts to put in perspective this worldview. And if many remember the bombings that took place in North Africa, where a tremendous number of Muslim people were actually hurt and killed in the bombing, and people were mystified. You know, they were like, why would they hurt their own people just to get a few non-Muslims, or as they call us, infidels? And the answer is an interesting one, because it just is so contrary to American and Western values. And this is the saying or the phrase that's used, and in English it translates, "Allah will know His own." Unquote. Think about that. Allah will know His own. Unquote. In other words, you throw the bomb into the kitchen and let God sort it out. And that's exactly, with great conviction, that they feel is in fact the case. In fact, the belief system is oriented around the idea that it's actually the short trip to heaven. You know, it's if you're placed in a situation where you are actually killed in the course of this so-called holy war, what happens is, you immediately go to heaven. You're spared all the trials and tribulations of this life. And anyone who's lived for very long knows that this life gives you a lot of trials and tribulations. So to be spared that in martyrdom is not only an honor and a pleasure, it's the shortest route and the surest route to heaven from a Muslim perspective. Now, why is that important in the context of Iran? Because in Iran, when the Ayatollah came in and took control, this is one of the things that is said in an 11th grade textbook, and I'm going to explain why that's important. Because actually now, you see, the Ayatollah and his government run the public education curriculum, that which educates, trains, and indoctrinates their next generation, just like our education does it with ours, just a different set of values, different set of ideas, many of them in the public system we might not even agree with. But the fact of the matter is, that's how public education works. And here's what comes in an 11th grade textbook, a quote from the Ayatollah. It says, and I quote, I am decisively announcing to the whole world that the world devours, the infidel powers wish to stand against our religion. We will stand against their whole world and will not cease until the annihilation of all of them. Either we will all become free, or we will go to the greater freedom, which is martyrdom. Either we shake one another's hands in the joy at the victory of Islam in the world, or all of us will turn to eternal life and martyrdom. In both cases, victory is ours, and success are ours. Unquote. This is the type of thinking that's not just ingrained, casually in a conversation. It is ingrained in their public education systems, from the time they enter school till the time they graduate. And since the Ayatollah and this form of government and thinking has taken Iran, it has now been 26, we're headed on to 27 years of that kind of indoctrination. And what does that lead to? Absolutely lead to is the absolute worldview and conviction that this is the way, in fact, that people should see the world. And this is the problem, because herein lies a huge, huge danger when you start to consider the effect of that kind of thinking on a multi-generational basis, where it's ingrained into people and they are raised to believe that death is preferable to life. And a worldview predicated on that is a worldview that in the West we will have a very difficult time defending against. Because here's what it says in the advent of a nuclear power. You know, what has kept the balance right now? You know, Iran is building, probably already possesses nuclear capability. You know, my oldest son is 28. He was able to spend some time right after 9/11. This is Nick. There's actually another Nick Begich. This is Nick 3. And Nick went to Tajikistan, and friends of his were involved in the government there, so he had a fair amount of freedom in moving around. He was the only Westerner he saw for 4 weeks, besides a French reporter who was trying to figure out how to get out of there. But the fact is, while he was there, he was able to observe several things. And one of those is the absolute availability and apparent free movement of nuclear materials. In other words, back then, these materials were already within black markets that were perceptible, that he was able to discuss with people there and find that, in fact, is probably more simple for Iran to have those capabilities. Even the Israeli, leading Israeli newspaper reported that there was enough plutonium unaccounted for from the Soviet Union to create 25 suitcase-sized nuclear weapons. Now, that's years ago. Things have been chaotic and have remained chaotic. Then you look across the world at the other potential source of nuclear weapons within the Muslim world, and you end up in Pakistan, which is a very, very delicate balance. The government that is there has been unstable or only stable by force of military, by a military government for some time. The idea that if, in fact, the military weren't in power in some of these places, it would most likely drift to something more more looking like what we have in Iran right now. Now, between Pakistan and India, there's huge conflicts. These conflicts are based upon religious differences between Muslims and Hindus that are extreme and intense. Both countries clearly, absolutely are armed to the teeth with both conventional and nuclear capability. If you look at the Pakistani situation, many will remember some years ago, one of their leading scientists was implicated for providing nuclear secrets to the Iranians. The fact of the matter is they probably have all of the intellectual power that they need to do exactly what we are most concerned about in the West. And here's the issue is it's not going to be like it was during the Cold War, mutually assured destruction as a deterrent. In fact, it's going to be that mutually assured destruction that is the catalyst, the incentive. This is why the situation is indeed so volatile, and also why when we start to look at sort of the international implications of our policy, we have to take into consideration other people's worldview. Even when it conflicts with ours, we have to understand it well enough to know that when we engage it, when those worldviews clash, they can either clash in a way that allows them to exist independently and away from each other respectfully, or they clash in a way that allows only one worldview to survive. And that has been the history of this country. And quite frankly, the root of all war is based on a different worldview. Now, when you look at this worldview, there's a couple of other points I want to make from this article that sort of anchor why is this so important? Where does this come from with respect to each other? And I want to just read another section of this article. And this one is... again, here's what it says, and I quote, "In Islam and in Judaism and in Christianity, there are certain beliefs concerning the cosmic struggle at the end of time, Gog and Magog, Antichrist, Armageddon, and for Shiite Muslims, the long-awaited return of the hidden Iman, ending in the final victory of the forces over good and evil, however they may be defined. The president of Iran and his followers clearly believe that this time is now and that the terminal struggle has already begun and is indeed well advanced. It may even be the date indicated by several references in the Iranian president to giving his final answer to the U.S. about nuclear development. That was August 22nd, just a week or so ago. And the year, August 22nd, corresponds in the Islamic calendar, which is a different calendar than ours, to the 27th day of the month of Rajab of the year 1427. This, by tradition, is the night when many Muslims commemorate the night flight of the Prophet Muhammad on the winged horse Barak, first to the farthest mosque, usually identified with Jerusalem, and then to heaven and back. This is from the Quran. This might well be deemed an appropriate date for the apocalyptic ending of Israel, and if necessary, of the world. It is far from certain that the president plans cataclysmic events precisely for August 22nd, but it would be wise to bear the possibility in mind. That was the president of Iran, and that's the unquote. We're headed to a break. I want to come back to this. This is a very important point and something many of us are just totally unaware of, and something I think we need a little bit of knowledge on. Where does the point of view come from that lead us to the place that we find ourselves in today? You're listening to Dr. Nick Begich with Changing the Way We See the World. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World. And you're listening to Dr. Nick Begich, and we're on RBN Live every Wednesday. Today's topic, we're talking a little bit about a point of view, the way, a different way to see the world, quite frankly, looking at the point of view of perhaps Muslims. According to a professor at Princeton University, and talking about what is currently happening in the Middle East and how that's percolating in a way that maybe, and is in fact quite contrary to our own national security, in fact to the security of the West. You know, it's the radical views that that really polarize. You know, we look at the Muslim people around the world, and most, and I have to emphasize this, most do not share these perspectives in terms of what's happening right now and aren't interested in contributing to it. However, it doesn't require a huge majority, you know, any more than the revolution that took place in the United States over 200 years ago. You know, it started with a very small number of people, perhaps as little as some scholars have said 6% of the population believed it was a good idea. So it's not the numbers, it's their focus, it's their commitment, it's their absolute zeal for that which they believe in. The things that motivate each of us, I mean, look around us, everything we've individually created has been sprung from that same drive. But it's the motivation behind the drive that has to be understood in order to look forward and to look for those areas. I mean, here's a commonality that I had never realized, you know, within the Muslim faith, reading this article, the idea that they too are waiting for this person to arrive that somehow redeems them. You know, the fact is most of the major religions, the three major religions in the Middle East, are all waiting for the arrival of someone to clean up the mess. And you know, I think if each of these faiths look at their own faith, it'll be, the message will be clear that we better be doing the first steps in that direction. And how we do that is extremely important. And I think that's, again, what drives people to their conclusions. You know, I read an article this morning, an AP story about Rumsfeld actually accusing people that are raising these kinds of questions as somehow helping the enemy. Well, I got to say, I have no interest in helping an enemy that's bent on my annihilation, quite frankly. And I don't think we can address it in the way many are approaching it from the old standard models of diplomacy, because we're not dealing with the same kind of thinking. In order for people to reach conclusions and compromises and agreements, they have to have a worldview that at least lends itself to a solution. And so looking at the worldview of our adversaries is incredibly important for us to find a way, to look for that way, that pathway that might allow us to coexist on this planet without wiping each other out. You know, the road to Armageddon, which is what everyone is fearing right now, and it looks like it's being painted by artists running the political processes of states around the world. The reality is it doesn't have to happen now. You know, anyone who has that belief that this is the end, you know, that belief has been shared by generations past. Each of these things is a warning to tell us to change the way we factually see the world and we act within it. And I think these are all warning signs for us to reconsider our root beliefs and root values and assess them in a very, very dangerous world. Today, the technologies are incredibly important. When you look at these articles and you start to read about the perspective, Israel is regarded as, by Iranians, and they're taught from elementary school on, that Israel is the little Satan and the United States is the big Satan. That's what they're taught in those countries. That's why there is so much energy focused against us, and yet we see this sort of inflaming of it at a point where we are going to have serious problems. I mean, the idea of this is people have said, well, you know, the fact that the Palestinians are so intermixed with the Israelis, they'll never nuke their own people. Well, the answer to that is that whoever's saying it is naive, because that is, in fact, what they will do. They'll believe that those struggling people within Israel that are of the Muslim faith will go straight to heaven. They'll be relieved of the burden of this life experience. And that apocalyptic view that takes them straight to heaven is the one that's driving this conflict. So why are the Israelis nervous about anybody even having the weapon? Because they know that the right person on the behind that button will actually execute, will actually do it, will push that button. What's the result of that? According to the reports and the analyses that I've read and studied over the years, Israel is capable of taking out every Middle Eastern capital immediately with the technologies that they possess, both nuclear and otherwise, should they be threatened in that way. And would they do it? Absolutely. And there you have it. You know, there's the scenario that unfolds. And it's really a matter of throttling it back so that nobody actually does it. But the probabilities are changing daily as we continue to inflame and they continue to inflame the West. And this is exactly where we're at right now. You know, when you think about some of the warnings and why the level of security and concern, you know, those are it. But you look at what took us into these places and what's kept us in these places has been almost a balancing act of trying to remain sort of in the position of influencing the tensions, but you can't do it forever. And you certainly can't suppress what people are, basically. And I think that's the problem. We cannot change who people are. Only they can change who they are. We're listening to Changing the Way We See the World, and that's something we can do. With good information, good knowledge, we can redesign at least how we interact with it and what we might be able to contribute to it. So you're listening to Dr. Nick Begich, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live. You know, this program has been really a good opportunity for me, at least, to get some of these issues that we never had the opportunity. I do a lot of radio work with lots of other hosts around the country. I've done that for over 12 years, and most people know me from strictly the technology issues, but these issues all interweave because the technologies that we use today, the things that we're doing today, are really changing the shape of the world. In fact, many of the technologies that we're talking about are the very technologies that now we fear the most. You know, we end up creating our own worst nightmares, it seems like, and it's just part of human nature, I suppose. You know, this thing with the Middle East has bred a lot of uncertainty, a lot of fear. You know, there's a lot of ways to look at these things. But I can say this, that most people that you meet really don't want to see that apocalypse happen. They don't really want to see this thing explode. It is a few on the edge, a few on the margin that just can't see past it to what is possible. And I think that's the challenge for us today. You know, the technologies today have the ability to annihilate us or to really free us to our higher and better potentials. You know, I went to Dallas last week to have a board meeting, actually, with the Lay Institute on Technology. And I want to talk a little bit about this in the context of this discussion today. And I also want to give our call-in number so we can continue this conversation. I'm sure others have insights that I don't have and knowledge that I don't have on this subject. And the call-in number is 800-313-9443. Again, for today, the call-in number is 800-313-9443. And I certainly would appreciate your insights. And I know many of our listeners really want to see this expanded a little bit. And I think there's always a hopeful message in all of this. You know, we see all the time this environment that's been built around us of fear and anxiety. And I sat last week for 4 days with one of the finest physicists in the world discussing exactly the nature of consciousness from a physics point of view. Now, that, I can tell you, was an interesting conversation. And in that conversation was also one of the most remarkable healers that I've ever met, natural healers, in my life. I couldn't believe it. You know, what I saw in that 4 days was truly remarkable. And having a world-respected physicist interpreting what we were seeing was even more remarkable. But in that discussion, you know, talking about sort of where we go from here, you know what the underlying theme and how these themes really interrelate is how much potential each of us have if we would just recognize it, if we would just quit living in an environment of fear and start stepping into who we are as human beings, each of us in our own way, great things would change, significant things would change. You know, in that meeting with these folks, I learned a lot. I was able to share a lot. But the business of the meeting was essentially to go down and to conduct our board meeting. The Lay Institute on Technology was set up to educate the public and provide information on new technologies to support that kind of effort. And we set up a website for this purpose, and it is thelayinstitute.org, LAYinstitute.org. And on that site, what we're putting in is my research search engine, the articles, the things that you hear me quote from on this program and others. Eventually, all 20,000 of our documents that we currently have archived will be online and available to people. In addition to that, some of the leading scientists that we're connecting with around the world, and they are really interesting folks, many of their papers have not been published, have not been able to get that kind of visibility that maybe leads to some great breakthroughs and some big changes. We're going to be posting their papers as well, along with a little bit of a profile on each of these, what we'll call the Lay Institute Visiting Virtual Scientists, and people that can really add to some of the things that we're concerned about, both in terms of information, but even more importantly, in terms of solutions. In fact, I want to talk a little bit about, so I can talk a little bit about what happened in our board meeting. A couple of projects got initiated. The first project is one of the archiving, which we've talked about, and adding to that website, making that information available. And by the way, all of that information is free. There's no sign-up charges. There's none of that. We want people to get that information, duplicate it, send it out, get it to people so we can educate this planet maybe a little bit better on the impacts of these technologies. Now, the second part is I'm going to be able to have a person that will assist me in coordinating volunteers, people who are interested in specific technology issues where we need research threads followed, we need information collected. I'm in Alaska. We have listeners all over the world near academic libraries, research institutes, places where we may not be able to get to extract that bit of information that might help bring clarity to these issues and really help us get that information more available to people. So we're going to be announcing how those projects are going to be running sometime in early October, but they have been funded for the next 18 months, so we'll be able to carry that work forward and really try and pull together some of these really distant pieces of information that give us a more complete and accurate picture and perhaps a different direction for many of these technologies. The other thing that we agreed to do, and it's going to be coming up, is we're going to put together a meeting of some of the finest minds that I've had the privilege of meeting in my travels around the world, that I have met some truly remarkable people, to get around these big technology issues. These are people who have risen and fallen in their own careers, risen from their ashes, if you will, of disasters, and yet maintained the content of their character, their ethics and moral fiber, and they're some of the finest scientists on the planet. And our objective will be to get around some of these issues and look for ways to solve some of the big problems, and without the governmental institutions that end up abusing, misusing technologies where they end up working against humankind instead of supporting who we are as human beings at our very core. So we're looking forward to that. That conference has been funded. We're going to put that together. It's a closed conference, but coming out of it, the work that we have that comes out of it will be posted in a way that people can access it, and we're pretty excited about that. All of these things really give us a chance to give these issues at least an open debate and to see the light of day. Now, outside of the Institute, a lot of the issues that we've covered over the years, and we've covered a lot of them that are on technology issues, we are organizing that work in a much different way, because there's a political component that private foundations can't get involved in, and those political components deal with the issues of policy decisions. And we have some policy decisions that are facing us as Americans and as citizens from whatever country a person might be from. But the idea that technologies now can be used to enhance our capacities or limit them is an incredibly important area of research. And I want to kind of shift the topics today. I wanted to open with this Middle Eastern point of view because I think it's something we all need in sort of the backdrop of the national pablum that we hear in our regular mainstream media. You know, we need to have a perspective on this and what it really means when we read those news reports. What is causing these people to act? Doesn't mean we agree with them by any means, but we need to understand the adversary in order to properly map a strategy that leads to a solution and not our own annihilation. And I think that's what's missing in much of the public press reports on the Middle East. I've got Roger in Pennsylvania who's been hanging in with me. Roger, why don't we work you right into this conversation? You have something on your mind. What's on your mind, Roger?
Yes, thank you, your manifold grace. I was kind of hoping, not necessarily today, but if you'd like to, but for months now, take some more like raw or general or say questions oriented to philosophy about epistemology and such, which I think are very influential on what goes on today, and all too often really are sort of a pseudo-intellectual rationale rather than a robust intellectual rationale for what's being shoved down our throats. And epistemology and such, if I didn't mention that. And in the Easter, or rather the, not Arab per se, but Muslims have their own eschatology too.
Yes.
And that is doctrine of last things, and that plays a role here too.
Yes.
And all this lopping off the heads of Christians and Jews and such, this is sort of reserved towards the end time of their eschatology.
Right.
So, and while we may have this clash of civilizations, apparently it's our government's, or the Bushonian cabals, they've assigned to us this role of bringing this clash of civilizations to a head here and now instead of 100, 200,
right,
or more years from now, right?
Absolutely. In fact, it's almost like they're playing it out that way, like they want it to be in a hurry. So they, you know, it's almost the same if you think about it as an apocalyptic view of Christian believers, all right? And I consider myself that, all right? I don't usually say that on the radio, but I do consider myself that. But, you know, waiting for the apocalypse and ushering it in as our quick ticket to heaven is not the answer either. And this is what we're seeing, is that same mindset as, oh, well, let's get Armageddon over with so we can get the second coming underway. Well, that isn't our calling as human beings, to watch the destruction of the planet so we can get the next thing underway. That's a selfish kind of self-centered motive, I think. You know, when we look at the root belief, you know, what leads to Armageddon, if from that perspective, is Revelations 11:18, which says God will destroy those that destroy the earth. Well, Armageddon looks like a lot of destruction to me, and I don't want to be in that camp if I can help it. And I think that's what we miss in this picture.
Yeah, it's their job to make as many Muslims the world over think that this is the plan according to their scriptures. So now we can start with extra vigor to start lopping off the heads of Christians and Jews, etc. Beyond that, it was kind of, usually I tend to plug at times the McLaughlin group, not because there's some like big outstanding and regular dollops of truth that come out on there, but it's one of the rare few venues where you have occasional truth leaks, you might say, owing to its fast pace.
Right.
And I hope everyone, if they didn't get it, download and listen to it at something like McLaughlingroup.com. It was going really bad or even had the neo-conning apologist, and on that venue, Tony Blankley, I guess, would be the lead role for the Bush team vision.
Yeah.
And it was really going badly for that vision on the cost of the war, both in terms of hundreds of billions, over $1 trillion, and lives, et cetera. So I hope everyone downloads that.
Yeah, I really appreciate the call, Roger. And, you know, it's not a time for doom and gloom. It's a time for wise people to wake up, and there's a lot of wisdom in each of us that we just need to start to exercise. We're not alone in this struggle. There's millions and millions of others believing the same. We just need to do what we know is right and true. I've got Jeff on the line holding from New Mexico. Jeff, are you still with me? Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, all right, good. You had something you wanted to say or a question you wanted to ask, and I appreciate your insight.
Yeah, I think that the world's sole superpower is actually Mother Earth, and the USA, Germany selling submarines to Israel, technological earth-stripping juggernaut, is a super snake whose venomous head will strike out not only at defined enemies, but also boomerang back and strike its own body. Likewise, the Russia, China, Iran technological earth-stripping juggernaut is such a dual-striking secondary super snake. And
let me bring that back down to everyone. You know, this idea of responsibility is really what you're talking about, responsibility over this planet and what this planet represents. And, you know, it's the outpouring of creation. No matter how we come from and come at it, we can't. Every one of us is totally awed by what this planet manifests. And the responsibility within all of the faiths is one of stewardship. And we forget this. We all forget this, that stewardship isn't about plundering. It's about making sure that this planet supports an abundant lifestyle, not a scarce lifestyle with everyone feeling somehow oppressed, but quite the opposite. The planet was designed as this incredible life-giving place that would provide us the opportunity as human beings to spring out of that and be responsible for that, in the same way that whatever our vision of the Creator is responsible for us. And we have failed in that responsibility in so many different ways. And yet, you know, we're not condemned to death even at the last moment. We have an opportunity to claim our birthright, do things that are differently motivated from the center of our souls, whatever that might be and whatever that might mean to each of us. But I know absolutely that if we do that, things will change. Absolutely. Daniel in Wisconsin, are you still hanging in there? Are you there, Daniel?
Yes.
Daniel, you had something you wanted to add to this conversation.
This weekend, Ahmadinejad inaugurated a heavy water reactor which will be capable in a few years of producing plutonium. Israel has its population preparing for nuclear fallout. The messianic madmen in Washington and Tehran are hell-bent to World War III. Isn't the time for the attack on Iran by the U.S. and Israel before Bush leaves office?
You know, that's a good point. You know, and I would probably be betting in favor of that happening. I mean, I think it's going to happen unless there's a lot of movement against it. I think there's just this idea. See, Bush introduced early on this concept called preemptive warfare, a new concept for warfare that we introduced when we first walked into the Middle East this time around. Preemptive warfare is a doctrine that essentially says when we think we have an enemy and we think we know what we're doing, we're going to just slap them down right away, just like, you know, your mom used to say, or some parents used to say, I'm going to spank you first thing in the morning just to set the tone right, you know. It's that kind of an attitude, and you go, wait, that's not fair, I didn't do anything. You know, there are people that believe that and actually project that, and we created a war policy on that. Now, why I have been so strongly opposed to that isn't in the current circumstance, it's in this one. We have developed, and I've reported on this in previous programs, people can look at them in the archive, but we have developed in the United States energy-based technologies, particle beam weapons, and weapons that work on the principles of electromagnetics and electromagnetic fields that travel at the speed of light, 186,300 miles per second. A laser can whip around. If you could bend it around the Earth, it would make it around seven times in less than a second. Preemptive war changes the face of the planet. We're going to a break. We're at the coming up on the top of the hour as well. So we've got one short segment. We'll be right back. Hang in with me on Changing the Way We See the World. And you can call in at 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443. And you're listening to RBN Live. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live. And we're here every Wednesday, 11 a.m. till 1 p.m., generally talking about technology issues. Today we've kind of moved around a little bit because all these issues really do work together. You know, we're talking about speed of light weapons just before the break and preemptive warfare. The importance of that is these new technologies are being evolved at a tremendous speed. In fact, next week we're going to get into some of those because I want to talk a lot about where these new technologies are and exactly what's happening in that realm so we can get a better perspective. So we'll get into that in next week's broadcast. But I want to talk about that concept of preemptive warfare. Now think about it. Whoever develops the next technology, the next really super technology, just like we have in the past, the difference is today the technology is flat. In other words, it could come from anywhere because information is so available across the planet. What if preemptive warfare is pointed at the United States? That's what I'm talking about, this concept. And would, in fact, our adversaries that we've seen emerge in the last decade do this? And the answer is yes, they would. The fact is we live in this volatile place at the present time on the planet. And here's what else is happening with this apocalyptic view of this administration. They're also shaping a different perspective on personal liberty and freedom, because to have the security, you almost have to push for the control. And it's about that control that is giving a great deal of insecurity to those of us that are concerned about these issues. You know, the idea of having a government that literally looks at us as if we're transparent, you know, from every transaction electronically that we engage in, everything that we do becomes increasingly transparent to government, so that sense of security increases. But it's a false security, because security based on ultimately fear. I had a really interesting interview recently about that. And, you know, the idea of fear and what motivates and comes from fear is usually not something very constructive. In fact, if you look at the actual physics of it, the biophysics of it, and you look at the brain of an individual who's experiencing fear, anxiety, or negative emotions, you have what are called incoherent brain patterns, those kind that absolutely do not lend themselves to good decisions. They only lend themselves to these base kind of reactions of flight or fight. In other words, run or get beat up. Or maybe beat somebody up. But the point is, that kind of mindset is replaced when you live in a higher emotional state. When you live in the emotions of compassion, love, confidence, you get what are called coherent brain patterns. Those that actually lend themselves to good, clear thinking. Well, it makes sense to me, both as a researcher and as a scientist, and as a person looking at sort of the deeper meanings to all of this. You know, God ordered it in a really neat way. We just finally figured out a little bit more about that order. That's what science does. It sort of analyzes the creation and figures it out in terms of the math. And the unique thing is when you see those two things merge, where the edge of physics is moving against the unexplainable, and that's where we are today with all of our science. That's why this program is on the air, because where we are today drives where we're going tomorrow. We're at the top of the hour. We're coming on the break. We're in for one more hour. You're listening to Dr. Nick. Stay tuned. We'll be right back to Changing the Way We See the World on RBN Live. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live. We're here every Wednesday from 11 till 1 Central Time, and we appreciate everyone who's been with us today listening, and we're into our second hour Roger, apparently I cut off in Pennsylvania too soon. He's been hanging in. He called back in, and I apologize for that. Roger, you had something else that you wanted to add to this conversation.
Yeah, and that's fine. No apology. I almost owe you an apology myself, actually, confusing you with Jim Fetzer. That's why I was pursuing that philosophical stream. But there are things that everyone should know about. If I could just... There's been a vacuum in talk radio broadly, and maybe especially on RBN here, in that the equal opportunity truth seekers of Judicial Watch, and this should be highlighted. These people should be brought on the Judicial Watch and the Gary Aldrich, Patrick Henry Center for Whistleblowers. See, these folks now apparently have become persona non grata on all these so-called conservative and so-called Christian radio shows because they actually do engage in some equal opportunity truth-seeking, pointing out that the Bush administration has become even more secretive, as if that were possible, which it is.
Yeah, it is. Hey, you know, I've got a pretty good latitude, and you know, the folks that allow me to have this program, and we have an agreement that essentially... As long as I can say what I want, we have an arrangement where I can be on the air. And you know what? I'm willing to bring these guys on. You send me the information on these guys. Go to my website at earthpulse.com. Shoot me an email. Give me the contact info. I'll check them out. As long as they have credibility, I don't have to agree with them, but let's have the debate, because without the debate, we can't have any good news coming our direction. We need a little more debate.
Yeah, my point is we should highlight the what should be the embarrassment of these fake and phony fraud Christian and conservative shows by the, you know, they used to have them on like once or twice a week on a slow week during the halcyon days of that rascally Philistine Democrat Bill Clinton.
Yeah, let me add something though to this, Roger, because you know I don't necessarily disagree with what you're saying in terms of a lot of the programs maybe see the truth a little differently, but let me suggest that anyone who's sincerely looking, I don't care where you look, you know, just keep looking. You know, and Christians should go back to King Solomon's story and remember the guy looked everywhere in the places that, you know, that God certainly didn't want him to go, but he went anyway. And you know what? It's not so much the looking, it's the not giving up and warming a bench. And if anyone believes this is the end time, there's a Christian verse that actually says at the end of the age that most churches will have a form of godliness but deny the inner power of it. And I think, sir, that's exactly what you're getting to, is when we forget who we are as creative human beings and what our full potentials are, and we execute them on a platform of compassion and love and the things that human beings are called to do, everything changes, and we don't have to wrap religion around that to make that happen. It wraps around us in the fact that each of us has that capacity to make a difference, and we forget that. We don't have to wait for some leader to pop up. It's already here. We're standing in it. It's the person within our own shoes. We just have to do a small bit. That adds up to everything else, and we forget it. People want to take power away from us and get us to forget that. I live in Alaska on the moon, and a lot gets done even from here.
Yeah, I did want to leave unsaid that Judicial Watch, yes, they may not go after all the truth that I would like them to go after.
Sure.
But they go after a fair good chunk of it, including demanding the release of the materials related to the 911 crashes, et cetera, you know, release the videos and other info. And
stay with me, Roger. Hang on. We're going to a break. Stay with me. We'll bring you back right after the break. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and this is RBN Live. Hang in there. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And the show is every Wednesday from 11 till 1. It's a chance to talk about a lot of different issues that are affecting all of us. And you know, today's program, when I started this out, I had no idea where we were going to end up going, and that's sort of the nature of these things. And, you know, and I'm pleased that we're where we are because, you know, it's information and the ideas and really what's behind the information that's more important. And today we've been talking a lot about sort of what's behind, what's pushing some of these things that we're seeing around us, both technologically and otherwise, And I think the background is important. I think what motivates people and what brings about these changes is maybe even more important than the changes themselves. And, Roger, you've been hanging in with me still. I know you had more to say, and I don't want to cut you off, and I keep interrupting you. So go ahead, Roger. What else do you want to add to this conversation?
Thanks. Just finish up with the Judicial Watch thing quick, and then one other
item.
And that is, Judicial Watch is pressing for the to put the conspiracy theories to rest, demanding release of the videos and related material on the 911 material, for example. And so another crew boneheadedly asserts, see, this proves they're not on our side. But that is a non sequitur, a boneheaded non sequitur, because one way of putting a conspiracy theory to rest is to prove a conspiracy true.
Right.
Converting it from theory into a truth.
Yeah.
So, and one might argue if there was any merit and that's what their purpose was, then one could say it would be pointless to demand release of the materials since they won't prove anything anyway. So why would they be pursuing that track?
Right.
So we don't want to engage in any sloppy thinking and,
right.
Just because somebody doesn't climb aboard every part of our particular bandwagon, that proves,
you raise a really important point because it's true. And you know, I met all of the guys that are in the middle of the 9/11 controversy. I was brought over to lecture with them back in 2002 in Switzerland, and we had the former defense minister of Germany as one of our speakers that was involved in that conference, and I had a chance to meet the experts, the ones that were really breaking ground on that issue, from Tarfleet to all the rest of them, you know. And what we saw and what I saw was an interesting set of circumstances, because a lot of good information, number one, that wasn't getting out, which concerns me as an American. Secondly, some of the information, the way it was being interpreted, I didn't agree with because I didn't think the facts supported it as I saw them reveal them. You know, people kind of take the story, too, and sometimes twist it, but they deserved an airing and a hearing because they raised some very, very serious questions about what exactly did happen and whether or not it could have been prevented and who was responsible. Now, whistleblowing as a mechanism, I think, is incredibly important. And whistleblowers sometimes are right and sometimes are wrong. But the mechanisms, the institutions that need to be created, after the HARP issue, which we've talked about in the past, I was able to get a resolution through the European Parliament to deal with that particular area of technology, along with non-lethal weapon systems. But coming into that whole debate, we had to not only evidence it, we had to evidence it in 10 different ways before we got people to make policy around it. And that's something, I come from a political background. My dad was a United States congressman. He was a state senator. My brother right now is mayor of the largest city in Alaska, Anchorage, and has been for some years. Family has a long political history, 3 generations of political history, and I can tell you change does not happen overnight. It first requires education, and then things become understood, and then things can change. And, you know, especially in the areas of science, because really interesting things that change not just science, but today in a technological world, look around the world, in the most powerful governments, the biggest threats of concern are those that control high technology. Whether it's us, whether it's China, whether it's the old Soviet Union and some of its states, or whether it's Iran holding high technology, or even the very, very small country of Israel holding very high technology. Technology in the advent of preemptive warfare, speed of light weapons, changed the game.
Yeah, and one really needs, like you might say, the maximum of interpretive speculations on what might have occurred.
Yep.
And in fact, the government's refusal to release this material not only merits
yep.
the interpretive speculations. And the only thing that could and should put these to rest is release of the materials.
Yep.
And we have a stupid buying by the nominal knuckleheaded conservatives of the notion that these are being withheld for national security, or that whopper, so we don't hurt the feelings of families who lost loved ones.
Well,
now, once you've seen a plane fly into the building, there's no amount of additional video that will increase one's pain if anything, it will put their own pains to rest.
Let me express that clearly. My father was lost in an airplane and never recovered. I personally have experienced exactly what you're talking about, and the truth, I can tell you, is more important than the lie. And my father died as a United States congressman. He died with Hale Boggs. You can look it up in the history books. And he was never found. 20 years later, we find out that our government knew where they were, knew two people were alive, and let them die on a glacier in Alaska. I know what it's like to be betrayed by our government. And any hidden truth is a betrayal of the fundamental values that my father died for, that Hale Boggs died for, and over 2,000 Americans died for in that World Trade Center. The real values, the things that root us as Americans, are disclosure, are the honest, true revelations of what is both good and what is bad within our government, so we as free people have the opportunity to change it. And we can't forget that opportunity to change is from truth, and whistleblowing needs to be integrated into our whole way of thinking, and not just for governments, but those multinational corporations that trample over our individual liberties and freedoms every day. And people would like to blow the whistle on those things that work against our interest, whether it's sole source contracts and evil contracts that yield $1,500 toilet seats for some military contractor instead of bread and wine for the poor, you know? I mean, what is wrong with our value system when we can do that and allow it to go on generation after generation? We have been robbed of everything that is humane. Our civil society is disintegrating by not the actions of everyone else, but by our inactions as conscious individuals who know that we should be doing something. Not violence, not those kinds of things, but something within our sphere of influence, whether it's picking up the phone and calling a friend, whether it's calling your congressman for the first time in your life and voicing your concern about the direction of this country. Pick up the phone and do something. It takes 5 minutes. Overwhelm this Congress with action, and they will change. My father was there. I know what they will respond to. But people have to do it. We have to do it.
And the other boneheaded part of that, which has to be rejected at every turn we get a chance for the voice, is the notion that this would jeopardize intelligence gathering or national security or the prosecution of the cases against particular individuals. There's nothing that would jeopardize any of the prosecution seeing the actual ostensible aircraft, et cetera. Like, you know, you'd even be able to see anybody's face through a window or something which could compromise a case. That's absolutely ridiculous. And so this is not about national security. This is about the securing of the office holders against what would be appropriate prosecutions for treason, not mere malfeasance, but treason and outright criminality. That's what's being protected. And that's why, like, it might say in foreign intelligence gathering, there might be a case for keeping 80% of the material bottled up to protect sources and such. But when you're talking domestic intelligence, there'd be little reason to keep even 2% of it bottled up for any valid reason. And God bless, Dr. Nick.
Hey, thank you very much, Roger. You know, you're right. You know, when we talk about what's necessary for national security, usually it's the security of some individual that's hiding something their mother and grandmother certainly wouldn't want to see them doing. And the fact of the matter is, these are the people that are regulating so much of our lives today, and hiding government in an open society. Yeah, there's risks. We don't have to tell people how to build the bomb, but we ought to have a discussion about the bomb. You know, whether it's a technology we like or don't like, whether it's a civil liberty being violated, we ought to have the opportunity to have that discussion. No government knows all, is all, and should be all, because no government stands alone. It springs from the people. Us, each of us, are the government, and we need to grab a little chunk of it back. You know, when I look back on all of the things that have happened in this country, every time that we've hit the 5 minutes to midnight, when things are really tough and people are looking around going, you know, how am I going to pay my heating bill this winter? You know how many elderly people around this country right now are worrying about that when we shouldn't be worrying about it at all? You know, the problems that we're facing today are resolvable. These technologies need to be turned to building this planet, building human life, increasing our potentials, not destroying us. This idea that we're on a one-way road to Armageddon, which is sort of how this program began today, is really not the direction that we can choose a different direction. We can make a different reality if we decide, if we each decide to begin to act on what we believe to be right and true. That doesn't mean you have to take on some big project that's out of your reach. What it means is we do what we can do, what's within our individual spheres of influence. It might be talking to your neighbor. It might be handwriting a letter to a congressman. Whatever it is, whatever that issue is, act on it. Do it every month. Do something to make a difference. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World. Call in and get in this conversation at 800-313-9443. 800-313-9443. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live. You know, I want to mention for those, and I always forget to do this, I've got to give my website. It's earthpulse.com, www.earthpulse, earthpulse.com. That's my website. Lots of videos, books, articles are there. It's a commercial site. It's not like the Lay Institute, the nonprofit side of what I do. The Lay Institute is about technology and education. That's at L-A-Y Institute. .org, and it was founded by Dorothy Lay, one of the heirs to the Frito-Lay family, the family that put together Lay potato chips, merged it with Frito, later merged it with PepsiCo, and she is supporting much of our research and educational outreach these days. We very much appreciate that support. It's allowed us to really take a lot of this discussion to a higher level in the sense of making it more and more available to the public. And I think that's a very important aspect to this, you know, getting these issues out. On the other side, the commercial side of what we do allows me to continue to make a living, support my five kids, and do the things that I need to do in life. At the same time, it is the political voice, because corporations, and it is a corporation, can say and do what they want, you know, without too much constraint. And it's a little bit more liberal in the sense of being able to say what I want to say about the political outcomes and the directions in which we're going, because those directions are neither liberal or conservative. They're either going to be in our human interest or they're going to work against us. And right now it seems like those forces are conspiring against us. And coming out of the sea of politics myself and my family being from that place and understanding it, I know we can change it. That's what I really know. You know, it's amazing when you understand the process and how the process is responding to you, how to make a change or move. You know, and when I think about, like, here in my part of the world right now in Alaska, there's been a story that I was out of Alaska when the primary took place, a story about our Republican primary, where Murkowski, our governor, lost his primary in a three-way race. And he was, before that, 20 years as a U.S. senator representing Alaska. So, I mean, this guy has a long career in the U.S. Senate, a successful, from his perspective, election for his first election as governor. And the news reports on CNN and around the country said, well, the reason he lost is he gave his vacancy, his U.S. Senate vacancy, when he became governor under our rules, he got to appoint who he wanted, so he decided to appoint his daughter, you know, kind of give her the hereditary throne. You know, it was pretty bizarre, but it made a lot of people mad. But it wasn't the reason he lost the election. It was just a small thing in the laundry list of this guy's political career. What was interesting is it was over oil and gas policy, which is, again, the stuff of the Middle East and where we started this conversation. And I'm trying to tie this back together, which I had hoped to do. Here's what happened. Murkowski was running against a guy named Binkley, who was a very nice man and a very good Alaskan, five-generation Alaskan, knows the story, knows the history here. I think a lot of him, quite frankly, and Sarah Palin, who I think a great deal of as well. And Sarah was previously the mayor of Wasilla. She was on the Oil and Gas Commission. She was being paid $130,000 a year under the present Governor Murkowski. And while she was on the gas commission, she discovered that this guy named Rudrich, who was running the Republican Party here, was kind of running it from his public employee's position. and he got caught, got the highest ethics fine in the state's history. But the governor wouldn't get rid of him until the guy finally had to resign, because it was obvious when the ethics violations came down and they were the biggest in the state's history. But he's still running the Republican Party up here, and Sarah got mad, and so did a lot of Republicans. In fact, in this primary, we saw what conservatives did, because Sarah blew the whistle on him, lost her job, quit her job, quit a $130,000 a year job on principle, and said to the governor, I'm blowing the whistle on you, I'm filing the ethics complaints, and she did all of that. And you know what? She stood up when nobody would, and she just won 51% of the primary vote in a three-way race in Alaska. A vote won not on the old paradigm. She was outspent by the incumbent governor 2-1, and Binkley, with almost $380,000 of his own money in this statewide campaign, and another $750,000 he raised, outspending Sarah 4-1, she beat them all. She cleaned their clock. She knocked them right out of the ring. It was the most exciting race I've seen in over 20 years because she won. And all the voting machines, they screwed up, so they had to hand count the ballots, and she won. It was the best victory we've seen. Now, what it says to me, and it's a signal to me, it's a signal to all of us, she is a conservative igniting that kind of interest again in making change on the right platform of values and ethics. Then at the same time while I'm out traveling around, I saw the CNN reports on that congressman, the Democratic congressman, incidentally, on the other side of the spectrum, coming out of Ohio, the black gentleman, Obama, I believe is his name, when he was in Kenya. And watching Africans respond to an American political leader with that much enthusiasm and compassion and love and outright enthusiasm, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it in decades. You know, that's the change. Those are the people. We need to look around our communities all over the country and all over the world and identify those people and see that they have the support they need to make the difference, to make the change, to changing the way we see the world. That's the name of this program, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we'll be right back right after the break. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. This is RBN Live. Pass the word on. Let other people know that we're around and that we're doing this work. If you think this program has been useful to you, please let other people know that we're here and that we're doing this work. And support this network. You know, this network is what gives us the chance to really express ourselves and lay out some issues with a little more time than the 30-second news blast that you might get on the 6 o'clock news. You know, we can get into the issues a little bit, explore them from a lot of different points of view, and hopefully change our own points of view along the way. You know, there's a lot of good information out there, and callers contribute so much to this program. I appreciate the callers. I want to give that number again. It's 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443. And I want to go back to something Roger had mentioned earlier. You know, he was talking about the 9/11 incident. And I was telling this story recently. You know, the day of 9/11, I was working in my office. You know, we're 4 hours earlier than Eastern time here in Alaska. And I generally get up around 5. So I actually watched that event unfold that morning. And then I had occasion where that day I needed to go up to one of the native villages here in Alaska. That's one of the federally recognized tribal organizations. And I was meeting that morning with the clan grandmother, who is a very, very close friend of mine. And, you know, grandmothers mean a lot to me. Grandparents mean a lot to me. You know, my grandfather was an immigrant from Yugoslavia, from Croatia. He didn't speak very good English. My dad was a highly educated man. And watching their interactions when my dad was a senator and a congressman, you know, and how much respect he held for his dad taught me a lot. It's not how a person speaks. It's not what they say. It's not how educated they are. A great deal of wisdom is held by those who have experienced life to its fullest extremes, both good and bad. And so I sat with my clan grandmother. She's 80, 85 now, and I sat with her that morning, and I asked her what she thought about all of this. And her answer to me was simple, and she said, you know, Nick, I'm not going to hate this time. And I looked at her, and I said, what do you mean? And she goes, In World War II, everybody came around and told us we were supposed to hate the Japanese. And then Korea came around and we were supposed to hate the Koreans. And then other wars came around and we were supposed to hate them. And you know what? I never met any of those people. And I don't hate them. And this time, I'm not going to hate anyone. And you know what? That's a message for all of us from a very wise woman. There's a time to recognize and defend ourselves. Absolutely. No one will deny that. But let's do it because we have to. That's what security is. Security is based on values. National security without values is fear and turns to destruction every time. National values based on a platform of doing the right thing doesn't mean we're weak. It means we recognize what we see when it's evil, and yes, like our grandmothers, sometimes we need to be swatted down. But that shouldn't be like our grandmothers. Our first response. And that's where I think we make the mistake in so much of our foreign policy. And it breeds the violence we have. And now we're in the middle of that violence. It's not, you know, there's a lot of criticism coming from the administration right now that people that are opposing the war and opposing this and that are somehow like the people telling the world about, you know, to negotiate with Hitler. Well, I wouldn't suggest negotiating with Hitler. I'd suggest swatting him down. And certainly the people behind the scenes that are doing these despicable acts, certainly, unfortunately, we have no option but to swat them down. But in swatting them down, let's not approach it like our adversaries do and throw the bomb in and let God sort it out, which is what we've done. You know, if we really look and are honest with ourselves and we look at the first Gulf War, the first conflict, over three-quarters of the casualties, almost some say a quarter of a million people, were civilians, women and children. They were the ones we were letting God sort out. And, you know, since the time during the embargoes, when there was no war going on, a million more perished. You know, that's, I'm sorry, but, you know, I see no difference in that than what's happening even in the Middle East. You know, when you look at the Middle East today, you see the Israelis putting Palestinians in the equivalent of ghettos, what happened in Poland during World War II. And people are upset. You see the anger and the violence coming out of the Palestinian people against the Israelis. Everything breeds just more violence and more hatred between people. And ultimately, it's like my grandmother said, I don't even know these people. But I do know that they're human beings with the same fears, the same insecurities that each of us have, and at the same time, the same potentials. And it's the way we see the world that determines those potentials. You know, we started today with a discussion about a worldview held by some Muslims in some parts of this planet. And we've talked about that worldview and what it breeds and how it manifests in the planet today. And we've talked about the alternatives to that worldview, which is a worldview that starts with each and every one of us. It's the idea that we are not helpless. We are not impotent people. We're quite the opposite. And, you know, I've said this all over the country, and it's not about the winning. You know, everybody is so hung up and so worried about criticism and losing or making a mistake. It's not about the winning. It's about the trying. And I think this is what every grandmother that would listen to this would agree with is, the greatest failures in our lives, greatest challenges in our lives, actually were the platform from which our lives began. It's from where we see our strengths and begin to exercise them as human beings. And everyone with gray hair knows what I'm saying is true, that it's only through those tough experiences that we become the human beings that we are. And by the time our bodies start to fade, we find out a little bit more, and then no one wants to listen to us anymore in this culture. In other cultures, it's the opposite. What happens is the combination of young people with lots of energy, but not the experience and the direction, and a different language, for goodness sake. But when that's combined with the wisdom that's generated by the same kinds of life experiences and the ability to interpret those life experiences into a life that is long-lived should be respected. And the combination of young people listening to this program with elderly people who have that experience, then everything can change. Because it's about that. It's about recognizing multi-generational history, being able to understand what's happened by having enough time to have lived through it. You can't do it in a book. You can't do it in your head. You do it in living experiences. But what you can do in your head and can do in a book when combined with living experiences is quite powerful. You know, I've been blessed in my life by always having lots of elderly people. You know, I was sitting with a woman this last week who I described as my Aunt Katie with a Ph.D. She had the same nature as my clan grandmother, Aunt Katie, that I've just talked about. But at the same time, she had that Ph.D. In physics and a Ph.D. in biophysics and a bachelor's in and a graduate degree in chemistry, and on and on and on and on. And yet out of her voice came through the cloud of book learning real wisdom that elders share and elders have. And we need to respect that, and we need to start looking at that a lot more seriously. You know, what she said at 9/11 really gets back to those base values. And we talk about, you know, I listened to during the break of the novel that's being promoted about the struggle between the liberals and the conservatives. You know, that struggle is like the bands of DNA. They entwine around each other. They don't touch each other. They're different from each other. They're totally the opposite. And yet, within them contain the very values that bring us together. Those are the root values of this American culture, this constitutional government that was put together with the wisdom of the combined thinking of not liberals or conservatives, but human beings who would express themselves through their own political voice, however they would choose to express it, and invigorate the public debate that would lead us to greater truths about each other when we did those, when we engaged those debates honestly. Not in 30-second sound bites of modern politics, not in the 3-minute little presentation of what we call a debate, but in the free-flowing dialogue of honest discussion that shows you who the heart of the individual is so that we can make informed and intelligent decisions. Don't let them off the hook this year. We have people running for public office all over this country, all over this planet, and let's put them on the hook this year. Let's ask them the tough questions. Let's make them deal with the big issues. Let's not let them skate by. Let's hammer them all the way through their campaigns by asking the tough questions and insisting on honest answers. And I think that's the challenge of the 21st century's politics, is to recognize that the divisions, the divide and conquer mentality to keep us apart on the main issues are allowing them to slip away where we'll never be able to debate those other issues that are so important to each of us. We must maintain our platform of liberty and freedom, and for that, liberals and conservatives can agree, and I've seen it happen. I've been lecturing for 12 years all over the country on technology and on the impacts of technology, and what I have always consistently seen is the shaking of hands between the left and the right when we understand that it's our very principles, the foundation of who we are and what we can become, that is at risk, and that we all must defend. You know, in my family, there were 6 children. My mom and dad, God bless them, they raised 6 children. Dad disappeared when I was pretty young, and the youngest was 4, and we evolved very differently from that point. Biggest disaster for me as a 14-year-old was the loss of my dad. But I can tell you, it was also the beginning of my life. It changed me dramatically. My brothers and sisters and I are totally different in our politics. We go from the most conservative side of the spectrum to the most liberal. And yet, when we get together, we have the most lively events in terms of family gatherings, but from a platform of compassion and love and an absolute right to believe and feel what we feel. And, you know, whenever one of us needs each other, we're always there for each other because of those underlying values. And yet, we disagree on so many other things in terms of our politics. And I think that sort of reflects the family of humanity, you know. I mean, that's what we all should be about. We should be tolerant, not accepting what we don't agree with, but tolerant to say everyone is on their own steps to learning what the truth is. As long as they're looking, let's give people the privilege and the pleasure that God even gives them, which is their free will to look where they wish, pursue their right to life, liberty, and their pursuit of happiness, even though we may not understand it. If it doesn't trample over us, let them do it. Let them look. One day, all people arrive at the same point in truth. It's when we quit looking, when we start warming the bench and lying to ourselves and everyone else that nothing meaningful happens. And, you know, all of this is about, you know, again, about how do you empower people? What can you do? You know, the words we use are the step in that direction. You know, we get into a lot of technologies that are coming that are designed to kind of hold us back. But the other side of this is the technologies and the things that are coming to lift us up. We're going to be doing more programs in the future, and I want to mention a couple that are going to come up. I got this excellent book from an editor who has spent his life studying the works of Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson. And I got this wonderful book from him that I've been reading and looking at, and he's going to come on in September for a couple hours. And we're going to talk about those root values of Jefferson, some of those root values that brought the American character to where we are today. Maybe we'll remind ourselves with this expert's interaction exactly those things that maybe our founding fathers would like to remind us of today. So we'll revisit Jefferson. We'll bring him back through his written words, because those words are powerful words, remain powerful today, from one of the world's experts on Jefferson. So that's coming up in September. One of the other areas, we've talked about alternative energy issues and alternative energy solutions, and there's a couple of things. I'd gotten an email after one of the programs from one of the specialists in underground shelters that use very little energy and create maximum heat retention, coolness in the summer, cut energy costs dramatically. And then the opposite of that is above ground, specially designed homes that do the same thing through the use of domes and what domes do and how they are structurally. So we're going to do a show with an hour on each. So we'll talk about those two alternatives and what they can yield in terms of energy, which is a big issue now. You know, people who are even contemplating home ownership, there's reasons for these structures. The other is where you live. You know, dome homes will handle a 300-mile-an-hour wind. You know, that's like hurricane-force winds. It's a nice structure just because of the way in which air acts over the curvature of the structure. The same is true with the underground homes. They can withstand tremendous wind velocities safely. So, you know, there's things we need to be looking at. Energy is a big issue. Energy conservation through good sense is a simple thing. So we're going to talk about that in future programs. We're going to also be bringing in some of my friends in biophysics to talk about healing, both from the standpoint of the laying on of hands and what that means from a physics perspective. I think this is going to be one of the more interesting shows we're going to be doing. The physics scientist that we're going to bring on has published over 200 papers and peer-reviewed journals in physics, one of the experts in the world. And I had the unique opportunity of seeing her in action with a device that she designed that she's actually gotten a U.S. patent for and FDA approvals for mitigating pain. Real exciting stuff. We're going to be talking about that in upcoming programs. Our role in this regard is to try and help these scientists that are doing these really remarkable things see their science advance. And what we found and the good people that are doing really good work, they don't want to sell it off to the pharmaceutical companies, to people that are going to bury technology. They want to find a way to make sure their technology is as flat as possible, as accessible as possible, so people can actually use it and not feel they have to mortgage everything they've worked their lives for to have it. Medicine is changing. Electromedicine is going to be the biggest changes coming, and we're going to bring to you some of the best biophysicists in the world on this topic. We're going to bring a few back, in fact, into an environment where we get them over to the United States. We're able to do some film with them, perhaps, on some of their big ideas that are really big ideas. And they have the science behind them to make things happen. So we'll be bringing that in the coming weeks as we continue to evolve our role in RBN Live and what we can bring to this program and bring to its listeners. And, you know, if you like what we're doing, let us know that. Let RBN know that. If we're just so far out there for you, let us know that, too, because, you know, we want to be effective. We want to use this time to educate the public. And really, all of us together, I think we can. I know we can make a huge, huge difference. And you know, this program, again, you can call in. You can add into this discussion. We can go where you want to go. You know, Roger's calling me back from Pennsylvania, so he's got another thing he wants to say. Let's work him in right now. Roger, are you still with me?
Yeah, you decided to suffer through another helping. Well,
that's okay. I think you've stimulated some good discussion, and I'm sure listeners are appreciating it.
Yeah, I've been... I've been trying to fight sloppy thinking here all around. I just on the subject of that left-right paradigm, it is, of course, increasingly, not inaccurate, but inadequate.
Inadequate is a good one. Hang in there, Roger. I'll take you right after the break. This is RBN Live. You're listening to Dr. Nick, and the program is Changing the Way We See the World, and I hope today we're doing that. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And for those that are just tuning in, we're at the end of the second hour, but we're back again next Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. And the program is Changing the Way We See the World. Roger, are you still hanging in with me?
Yeah, thanks. As myself, self-described ultra-right wing as tightly defined by strict constructionist constitutional, I'm all for joining with lefties on particular or lumped issue advocacies,
right,
nevertheless.
Right.
But you go through a laundry list of any 20 or 30 items, whether it's getting rid of the Federal Reserve, getting rid of the illegal alien invasion, the
right,
deportations, et cetera.
Right.
All of a sudden, you're going to see if,
oh, yeah,
by some miracle of outbreak of sanity, you're going to see this left-right paradigm,
oh, yeah,
reassert itself into actual relevance.
Yeah, it, you can't help but, you know, see those issues emerge. But again, you know, I think all of us are interested. You know, I consider myself conservative in a very liberal family, incidentally. But, you know, I always joke with my brothers and sisters, I'm the white sheep of the family because I'm the conservative amongst the sea of liberals. But, you know, it really, I agree with you. But those fundamental issues, that's where we anchor. And then we get real lively with our debates on the other things that are really important to us. I mean,
yeah,
they're not light issues.
Well, once we see the necessary deportations even almost start to begin, you're going to hear this caterwauling, wailing, gnashing of teeth. And where will that come from? The left.
Well, I'll give you my example on immigration. I was in Southern California during the big immigration protests lecturing. And why I was in Southern California beyond lecturing is I was getting ready for a dental appointment. And here in Alaska, dental work is very expensive. I needed some pretty extensive work, and I couldn't afford it. I mean, if I couldn't afford it, it was $3,500 I didn't have. So for $350, I went across the border and got my teeth fixed. Now, while I was waiting to go across the border for me to run to Mexico, I watched a CNN report on illegal immigrants coming to the United States, and their first stop was to a doctor's visit and a dental chair where they got the same care on my tax dollar. Now, I can tell you, I was mad. You know, I'm going south of the border to do what I can't afford to do in my own country while I'm paying for a bunch of people who came here as felons, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm paying for it. I don't like it, and I don't like the upside-down equation of what has happened in the United States to all of us. I mean, the whole concept that somehow, you know, that being my grandfather came through Ellis Island. He came in the front door. You know what? And I don't hold it against anyone to want to come through our front door. But when you come in our back door and that the second largest industry in Mexico is illegal immigration money flowing back, and why is it flowing back? Not because Mexico is poor. It's because 20 or 30 families in Mexico control the wealth. We've propped up those families under the Clinton administration with a $40 billion bailout. It wasn't for the Mexican people. Immigration didn't go down because we bailed out their peso. We boosted up a corrupt government. Those people in Mexico, what they need is a solid door where they can't come through, and they need to have their own revolution. They need to have their own change in government that gives them a government that expresses itself with a lot more civility than the corrupt government that the Mexican people are forced to live under today. The change comes from the people, by the people, and that's our value, and those are the values that other countries need to recognize. Then things will change. Thanks for being with me today, everybody. We'll see you next week. This is RBN Live, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich.